Well, very nice presentation. If I may put it that way, I'm proud of you. I'm an oldster in the Federal Reserve family. But you really didn't answer to one question, which is why shrink the balance sheet at all? So I would like to hear what you have to say on that. And the other question is, can you imagine circumstances in which you actually would want to sell because you want to actually tilt the yield curve? In some sense, in the conundrum period, one might have thought that it would have been useful to be able to put upward pressure on long-term interest rates in that period.
Yeah, you could make an argument for using a balance sheet in a more aggressive manner. The risk with that is, I think we have so little experience with it, that say you were in a situation for financial stability reasons that you wanted to raise the long end of the curve, and you chose to do it by signaling that you were going to sell assets. You don't know how much you're going to sell. The market doesn't know how much you're going to sell. I don't know how much the market's going to react to that. And the market could very easily steepen the yield curve much more than I'm anticipating. So some of the logic in this talk is that because there's so much uncertainty about the balance sheet, that I'd much rather be manipulating things with the federal funds rate and leaving the balance sheet more in background. It's something we're going to need during recessions, but during recoveries, it's not something that I would necessarily want to use as an active tool. Now, there may be circumstances where inflation's taking off, financial stability, you're worried about asset prices taking off, and the Fed may make a different calculation at that time. That's not the situation we're in right now. So I think in the current circumstances, it's completely appropriate. In terms of shrinking the balance sheet, I think that there are some advantages to operating closer to a more normalized balance sheet. Some of those are political, that clearly it's been quite unpopular to have as large a balance sheet as we've had. You do worry about spillovers to other countries as well. And arguably, we don't need to force the long end to be unusually low. There's no reason why we shouldn't have a more normalized yield curve when we're basically at our unemployment mandate and we're basically at our inflation mandate. So ideally, we don't have to manipulate the yield curve. And I think as we get to where we're supposed to be, that it is appropriate that we exit to the extent that we're able to from the balance sheet that we have. So that would be the reason why I would actually start the roll-off now. And since I think that a roll-off is necessary, starting sooner allows me to be quite gradual. But it will have the effect of slowly increasing the yield curve, but it'll be slow enough that it shouldn't affect my ability to use the short-term rate to be the main way that I am hitting my inflation and unemployment rate goals. Are you going to call or am I?
You can go ahead.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. So you mentioned how the U.S. and the Federal Reserve has a fairly low inflation target being 2%, and that other countries, or it may be an option for other countries to increase their inflation target in order to seem more accommodative with their real rate. Do you think that any time in the future the Fed would use this as another unconventional tool in order to become more accommodative, or do you think that it would have larger negative impacts on the credibility of the Fed?
So right now, in the Federal Reserve and other central banks, the target is 2%. There are some academics that have argued it should be other than 2%. I'm just highlighting that there's a trade-off between picking a 2% inflation target and whether you're likely to hit the zero lower bound. So if you told me that under no circumstances do I want you to do an asset purchase in the future, then I probably shouldn't pick 2%, because otherwise it means I'm turning off monetary policy pretty frequently, and then I have to rely on fiscal policy. Between a higher balance sheet or relying on fiscal policy, my personal preference would be a higher balance sheet. So I think that we have to think about that trade-off. I think countries should. So the Bank of Canada does consider their inflation target every 5 years and ask whether it's appropriate. These are one of the things that we should be discussing on a regular basis, is how comfortable are we manipulating the balance sheet? The less comfortable we are, then you have to start saying, what are the pros and cons of having a higher inflation rate? It's a much bigger talk to talk about the pros and cons of changing the inflation target, but I think it's something that should be actively debated. I'll go 1, 2, 3.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you the same question as I was going to ask Peter from ECB. I was going to ask him about quantitative easing and about expanding the balance sheets and if that means buying a large amount of assets in the markets, what does that really mean? What are the risks of making asset bubbles? Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit about what does it really mean? How does it really affect the market when a big actor goes in and buys that huge amounts of assets in the market like that? What are the implications?
So one of the implications and one of the concerns is exactly the one that you highlighted, the potential financial stability. So you are, when you buy assets, if it's an interest-bearing asset, you're pushing the interest rate down lower than it would be in the absence of your purchases. And that's exactly what your policy is intended to do. So our intention was to make it easier to buy cars and houses. So in order to do that, you have to lower the interest rates. Now, it is possible to buy too many cars and houses. It is possible to have too much commercial real estate. That is the potential downside of using balance sheet much more aggressively. So I think asset bubbles and financial stability concerns, this is a fairly untried tool. It's a tool that we've used during this crisis. It wasn't just the U.S., it was Europe and it was Japan. But I think that we have to see, and part of that is, how effective are we at getting back to a normal balance sheet over time? So some of that concern would be, when is it appropriate to start exiting that balance sheet? And are you able to exit early enough that you don't allow some of those bubbles to become a serious problem? If you start waiting too long, and you're keeping rates artificially low for assets that finance houses or finance commercial real estate, then you do potentially have a problem. So that's why the exit strategy is just as important as the entry. So the entry was critically important. It was critically important because otherwise we turned off monetary policy once the short-term rate hit zero. I don't think that's good policy. But the true success is that we're able to get out of that policy as well, which is why I'd rather to start relatively soon, but do it gradually enough that I don't think it's a big problem.
Just one question, one quick question. What is the connection? How strong is the connection between the expansion of the balance sheet and the exchange rate? I mean, that leads to a higher devaluation and then try to export more, enhance the exportation. Do you have something to say about that?
So both short-term rates and long-term rates are connected to the exchange rate in meaningful ways. So I think that is a good question. That is something that we think about. We do have an exchange rate. When we're doing an economic forecast, we're not only thinking about what we're doing in terms of the short-term rate and quantitative easing, we are thinking about what we expect the effect to be on the exchange rate. And certainly one of the mechanisms that quantitative easing works is not just that we lower the rate, which encourages you to buy houses and cars, it's also it has an impact on the exchange rate. So actually right now, Japan and Europe are benefiting from the fact that we're raising rates earlier and potentially both short and long-term rates so that they don't have to have quite a stimulative policy because we're exporting less, but they're exporting more. So to the extent that we're exiting a little bit earlier, it actually is advantageous for our trading partners. That's the exchange rate mechanism working in their favor in this case. So you can't look at interest rates without thinking about exchange rates as well, so it does have an impact. Behind you, there are two questions.
A couple things.
You only get one. You right. Have a couple others.
There's a stress on about the need for a cushion, but how do we know that a quarter point cut these days with low inflation, low trend growth would have more of an outsized impact than it would have prior to the crisis, and therefore we won't need this cushion of 300 or 400 basis points? And then just quickly,
let me answer that question, then we're going to pass the mic just because there are a bunch of other people. But we actually know that lowering the short-term rates in this last recession wasn't enough. We hit zero, the unemployment rate was high, and the inflation rate was low. So in order to get to our objective, we had to do something differently, or you had to be willing to do Japan and just sit there for a long period of time. So Japan's an example of what happens when you decide to let interest rates get to zero and you sit there. You can sit there for a long time. They've sat there for more than two decades. I think that it's much more sensible to think about how do you aggressively achieve your targets. So I think the fact that we were aggressive on the balance sheet, that we were aggressive on short-term rates, is one reason why we're talking about exiting both the short-term rates and the balance sheet now.
Herman Minsky used to talk about reconstituted finance in the financial system in the U.S. in order to foster the capital development economy. And among the government and also the Federal Reserve functions of supervising the financial system and reconstituting that, what do you think about this Minsky's proposal? Thank you.
So bank supervision is probably not the topic of my talk. It was more the topic of Tom Honig's talk. But I actually think that you can't conduct good monetary policy without good supervisory and regulatory policy as well. And so certainly one of the reasons that we hit the zero lower bound, it wasn't just a random shock. It was a shock that decimated our financial system. So if we had been in a situation where our financial system was much more resilient, then we would not have needed to do the extraordinary measures that we actually did. So to the earlier question, this was partly a reflection of how severe the financial crisis was. But I'd go back to my federal funds chart that shows how frequently we decrease interest rates by far more than 300 basis points. Basically, other than the very first one in the early 1960s, every single recession we've lowered rates by more than 300 basis points. So we do have to think about supervisory policy. I was a bank supervisor as well as a macroeconomist. I think they're integrally related. It's why I think it's so important that central banks actually have responsibilities for bank supervision. So I do think we have to think about both what's happening to our banking system, but also the shadow banking system. And those are very important to thinking about how our monetary policy should be conducted. And to the earlier question, it gets to the financial stability issues. So I think those are very important issues to be considering. Those are separate from the macroeconomic tools of thinking about the balance sheet and thinking about the federal funds rate. So why don't I take two more questions, and then I'll stop. I'll take one here and then one there. I think there's a, what happened to the mic? Okay. Sorry.
Back over. Thank here. You. Trump has said that he wants low interest rate in order to avoid the overvaluation of the dollar, in order to avoid to lose competitiveness. And how the Fed is going to manage the inflation target with the wishes of the government in order to increase competitiveness.
So the inflation target is something that has been picked by our central bank and other central banks prior to the most recent period, certainly prior to this election. So we're setting an inflation target where we think it's not going to have a big effect on economic decisions overall. So there are some benefits to having a low inflation rate. And certainly having a stable inflation rate, there are a lot of benefits too. So in that chart, not only were we closer to 2%, but the volatility around 2% was less. So I think there are big benefits to having a low, stable inflation rate. The only point I'm trying to make in this talk is that there are trade-offs with, if you don't have much of a buffer, there are some good aspects to a low inflation rate, but there's a consequence when you have a recession and have to use balance sheet. So that's the trade-off that I was focusing in this talk. So one last question.
Thank you. Your first chart, which kind of showed the Europe, US, Japan, and Japan was sort of stuck here with little blips and then continues, and you said that's the biggest fear, the problem, you don't want to be there. But to me, and all the charts you showed afterwards and the discussion we're having, it looks like we might be in what Japan was 30 years ago, because it's taken us about 9 years to start slowly moving up. And if we have a recession, say next year, we might come down immediately. So we might look like Japan, because they had a little blip too. They tried to go up and they came down again, so they really couldn't go up. So we might be 30 years later looking at the same chart, and we might be very much Japan. You're not worried about that?
I worry about everything. But I would say that if you look at most economic forecasts right now, they expect that the growth rate's going to be a little north of 2% over the course of this year. So GDP for the first quarter looks like it's going to be half of what we were expecting. But most people are expecting a bounce back in the second quarter, reflecting more consumption, and then the third and fourth quarter to being a little bit above 2%. If you think potential in the United States is 1.75%, that's actually enough to continue to tighten labor markets and put upward pressure on inflation. So why are we pulling back on accommodation, both with our balance sheet and with short-term rates? It's because we're reasonably confident that we're at a place where there's a sustainable recovery. Now, that isn't to say that we couldn't have a shock, as the whole panel right before me is talking about one of the possible shocks, that you could have something happen in Europe, that could be a problem. You could have something happen in the South China Sea, that could be a problem. There are a lot of geopolitical issues that clearly could be a problem for the U.S. economy. So we can't prevent negative shocks from buffeting our economy. We can't expect, though, that negative shocks are necessarily going to occur. If they're really high probability, then we should be factoring that in. But most forecasters are actually expecting we're going to continue to have the unemployment rate drift down. A lot of the economic forecasts are actually for the unemployment rate to drift down to the low fours. That's much lower than historically we've had without getting some inflation pressures. So I think there is some, there's the risk that you highlight, which is that we have a bad negative shock and then we're back to the zero lower bound. There's also the shock of waiting too long and allowing the economy to get away from us. So we have to balance both of those, and that balancing act changes over time depending on what's happening in the world and in financial markets. I think we have the balance about right. I actually think that it is appropriate to continue to be raising the short-term federal funds rate, that I think that the economy is strong enough to sustain that right now, even though I'd say that the recent data has been a little softer than I was expecting. But I'm expecting it to pick up and that to continue over the course of this year. Same thing with the balance sheet. You don't exit your balance sheet if you think that you're about to go into a recession. But that's not my expectation. My expectation is the U.S. economy will continue to recover. I have no idea what fiscal policy will be, but I don't think people are expecting that it'll be contractionary. They're expecting it'll be expansionary. If that's true, that provides further stimulus to the economy. So I'll end there, and I'll answer questions over lunch, but thank you very much.